Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 4th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast first thing today, this coming from KCRG-TV. Showers exit early on, leaving behind slight cool down. Temperatures will be a little cooler today than in the past days, with a bigger dip yet to come later this week. A cold front is moving through the state early on Wednesday, with areas of scattered showers out ahead of it. These will move through quickly this morning, likely exiting to the east by about 9 or 10 o'clock. Eventually, we'll see skies become partly cloudy with a bit of a westerly breeze. All in all, the effect of this on our temperatures will be to keep us in the upper 70s to low 80s today, which is still warm for this time of year, but cooler than the past few days. After a pleasant Thursday, where we should see a decent amount of sunshine and temperatures in the mid to upper 70s, a second cold front moves through. This one packs more of a punch in terms of providing a change in our weather, driving temperatures downward into the end of the week. It comes with some blustery winds, too, with gusts potentially exceeding 30 miles per hour for a good portion of Friday. Some scattered showers are possible behind the front on Friday, as highs struggle to reach the mid to upper 50s. The coming weekend looks dry, but features highs below normal in the upper 50s to low 60s. Each day of the weekend could start in the upper 30s, too. This could put parts of the area at risk for some frost, though that potential isn't totally clear just yet. Stay tuned for more info on that as we get closer. A moderate warm-up takes place again next week, though we'll be headed for highs in the mid-70s at the warmest by the tail end of our 9-day forecast. This is a far cry from our recent record-breaking warm spell. And now to the front page, where we start with a story about this year's harvest season. The title is Harvest in High Gear, Assisted by Warm, Dry Weather Across the State. Dateline Des Moines. Warm and dry weather prevailed throughout much of Iowa last week, resulting in 5.7 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Field activities for the week were primarily harvesting corn and soybeans. Quote, with an assist from a burst of summer-like weather, combines are rolling across Iowa, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagg said in a news release. Quote, despite cooler temperatures arriving later this week, forecasts show mostly dry conditions through early October, which should allow harvest to continue at a steady pace, unquote. Topsoil moisture condition, rated 28% very short, 45% short, 26% adequate, and 1% surplus. Subsoil moisture condition, rated 36% very short, 43% short, 20% adequate, and 1% surplus. $175,000 in personal purchases were made by the Danbury City Clerk, report says. This story filed by Caleb McCullough and begins with a photograph of State Auditor Rob Sand. Dateline Des Moines. A former Northwest Iowa City Clerk may have made more than $175,000 in personal purchases on a city credit card over 2 years, according to a report from State Auditor Rob Sand. The report details an investigation into the city of Danbury's finances between March 2020 and May of 2022, when former city clerk Stacy Rockdashel was responsible for nearly all of the city's disbursements, receipts, payroll, and other financial reporting. The auditor's office found close to $100,000 in retail and wholesale clothing purchases on the city's credit card during that time. Rockdashel owned a boutique in town at the time, the report said, and city officials were concerned she was using city funds to purchase items for the business. That store, the Dash Boutique, closed shortly after Rock Dashiell resigned from her city clerk position, according to court records. Another $32,000 in city purchases during Rock Dashiell's tenure could not be accounted for, and there was an estimated $26,500 in missing utility cash payments. Rock Dashiell worked as the Danbury city clerk from March 19, 2020, until May 15, 2022, when she resigned. In spring of 2022, the Danbury mayor gave Rock Dashiell negative performance reviews and expressed concerns about billing being doubled up and her clocking in hours that were not worked. After she resigned, city officials reached out to the Woodbury County Sheriff's Office over those financial concerns. Rock Dashiell referred a request for comment to her attorney, who did not immediately respond. Danbury Mayor Brock Boyle and Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan also did not immediately respond to a request for comment. According to the report, $75,500 in city funds were spent on fashion wholesaler Fashion Go, along with almost $20,000 in other retail clothing expenses. The auditor's investigation also found close to $45,000 was spent on PayPal and Venmo purchases for women's clothing, skincare products, home decor items, and social media services. The auditor's office could not find documentation for an additional $10,800 in PayPal purchases. Another $14,800 was spent on various retailers like Bump Box and Etsy, as well as tickets to the Omaha Zoo and grocery items. The investigation found $16,700 in payments for personal online business services and social media. The investigation also found $17,600 in Amazon purchases, most of which could not be accounted for because they lacked documentation. More than $1,000 of those purchases were found to be for personal items. Rock Dashiell did not agree to be interviewed by the state auditor's office, the report says. The auditor's office also found thousands of dollars in missing cash collections for utilities and a local rented event space. The city did not maintain receipt lists for utility collections, and Rock Dashiell did not present a monthly utility reconciliation to the council, the report says. During the 27 months that Rock Dashiell worked as city clerk, only $3,900 in cash deposits were made to the city's bank account for utilities, the report says. In the 6 months before and after her tenure, deposits ranged from $6,000 to $7,000. On average, only about $143 was deposited each month Rock Dashiell was clerk, while the months before and after saw more than $1,000 in cash deposits on average. The auditor's office estimated that $26,500 in cash utility payments were not deposited in the city's accounts during Rock Dashiell's tenure. The investigation also found thousands of dollars were unaccounted for in rentals of a city shelter house. The city operates the shelter, and residents can rent it for events for a $125 fee. Rock Dashiell was responsible for collecting, recording, and depositing the cash and check payments for the shelter house. The shelter was rented 105 times, according to the city's event calendar, for a total of $13,125. But city officials could only locate 4 applications, and the auditor's office could only connect 47 reservations, totaling $5,875, to deposits in the city's bank account. The auditor's office found the city was not following proper financial oversight procedures, and Rock Dashiell had control over too many areas of the city's finances without any outside review. According to the report, city officials did not compare expenses and receipts, require itemized documentation of all expenses, or review the city's bank statements or credit card statements. The auditor's office recommended that bank statements be reviewed by an official who does not collect or disperse city funds, and bank reconciliations should be done each month. City officials should also regularly review the city's credit card statement and ensure all purchases have supporting documentation, the report said. Quote, city officials have a fiduciary responsibility to exercise authority over its funds, efficiently and effectively achieve its mission, provide oversight of the city's operation, and maintain the public trust, the report said. Copies of Sands' report have been filed with the State Division of Criminal Investigation and Woodbury County's Sheriff's Office, the report says. No criminal charges have been filed, but court records show two search warrants were executed for Amazon purchases in Rock Dashiell's name made with the city credit card. According to the warrants, Rock Dashiell contacted the city of Danbury after resigning and said she had been dealing with fraud and possibly identity theft. The warrant also notes that she failed to appear for an interview with Woodbury County Investigations. The first warrant, issued on August 23rd, returned 43 transaction records. The second warrant, executed on August 31st, broadened the request and noted that 43 records did not reflect all the fraudulent charges on the city's credit card statement. Now an update. One injured in afternoon shooting. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. One person was injured in a shooting in Waterloo Tuesday afternoon. Police said the woman was sitting in a car parked at Metro Mart, 2332 Falls Avenue, shortly after 2 p.m., when someone in a passing vehicle began shooting at another person running on foot. Bullets struck the victim's vehicle, and debris from the impact hit her leg, police said. Paramedics with Waterloo Fire Rescue treated the woman, and police said the injuries aren't life-threatening. Bullets also struck an office building across the street at 2315 Falls Avenue. Police found spent shell casings in the alley behind 2315, authorities said. No arrests have been made in the shooting. Next, a story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Waterloo man sentenced to life in prison for friend's shooting death. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man will spend the rest of his life in prison for shooting his friend in the head in 2022. Judge Linda Fangman sentenced Savion Devante Wilson, 24, to life in prison without parole, the only punishment for the first-degree murder under Iowa law, on Monday after rejecting requests for a new trial. Wilson, who fired a single shot into 26-year-old Cortavius Benford's head in Benford's Palmer Drive apartment on October 27, 2022, declined to comment to the court during the hearing. Benford's friends and family were also in the courtroom, but declined to comment. Witnesses said the two had been longtime friends, each moving to Waterloo from Mississippi in recent years. During trial in August of 2023, Wilson claimed the shooting was an accident. He said he had loaned Benford the weapon because he was interested in buying it. On the morning of the shooting, Wilson said he found the gun under Benford's couch, and he said he acted recklessly with the pistol, pointing it at Benford, and pulled the trigger. Benford's girlfriend told a different story. She said Wilson had briefly left the apartment. Prosecutors allege to retrieve a gun from a car, and then returned with a camouflage hunting mask over his face. Wilson stepped over to Benford and shot him before fleeing, she testified. Wilson later told police the gun went off while he and Benford were struggling over it, but forensic evidence suggested the muzzle was feet away and the wound was to the top of Benford's head, an unlikely spot if there had been a struggle. Prosecutors also showed that Wilson had threatened to shoot Benford, boasting it would be a free kill, during a Facebook Live video post in May of 2022, after the two had a falling out. The defense had requested a new trial based on the state's use of the Facebook video. The defense also argued there was no evidence of malice or premeditation leading up to the shooting. Wilson's defense attorneys also told the court they planned to file a written guilty plea for an unrelated drug possession charge. Court records show that weeks before the fatal shooting, police stopped Wilson while investigating a possible vehicle theft. Wilson ran from police, and officers eventually detained him and found a bag with more than 42 grams of packaged marijuana and $230 in cash. Nurse allegedly swiped pain meds from 50-plus new mothers at labor and delivery. Dateline Waterloo. A former nurse is accused of taking pain medication from more than 50 mothers at the maternity ward of a Waterloo hospital in 2022. Last week, prosecutors for U.S. District Court of the Northern District of Iowa charged Christina Eileen Olson, also known as Christina Hovey, 43, with acquiring a controlled substance by deception, alteration of a drug with intent to defraud, and making false statements in healthcare matters. Records indicate Olson began working for the hospital in 2017, and she was assigned to the labor and delivery unit in 2019 as a registered nurse, caring for late-term pregnant women, women in labor, postpartum women, and women recovering from recent cesarean section surgery. Beginning in January of 2022, Olson began accessing pain medications, including hydromorphone, fentanyl, and oxycodone, for personal use under the guise of filling orders for patients. Quote, for example, defendant withdrew pain medication from a secure dispensing machine at the hospital on the false and fraudulent pretense that a patient had an order for that medication when the patient did not have such an order, prosecutors noted in the charging documents. Quote, instead of administering the controlled substance to the woman in pain, however, defendant diverted the controlled substances to herself for her own illicit drug use. Defendant diverted narcotics from no less than 50 victims, the court records state. To cover her tracks, Olson allegedly replaced the missing drugs with saline and then completed paperwork that ultimately billed patients' insurance companies for the drugs, according to court records. Iowa Board of Nursing records and the charging documents indicate hospital officials became concerned following a March 2022 incident. A mother gave birth by a complex C-section surgery on March 23, 2022. Olson allegedly indicated she administered hydromorphone and oxycodone to control the mother's pain on March 25th. But the patient's husband told hospital staff she hadn't received any pain medication, records state. The following day, Olson underwent a drug screening at the request of the hospital, and the tests were positive for opiates and marijuana. She allegedly admitted to officials she diverted the pain medicine for personal use, according to nursing board records. As part of the settlement with the nursing board, Olson relinquished her license in August 2022 and agreed not to seek reinstatement for a year. Olson had worked at Mercy One Covenant, according to records and Courier archives. Now, in high school football, Sumner Fredericksburg spoils Denver's unbeaten season. Story filed by Ethan Petrick. Dateline is Denver. Sumner Fredericksburg came out on top in a battle of Class 1A football heavyweights on Friday. The number 7 Cougars picked up their second consecutive top 10 win and ended number 4 Denver's unbeaten season with a 19-7 road victory on Sharp Field. Sumner Fredericksburg head coach Jacob Coyle said he is pleased with the last two showings from his team in weeks following the Cougars' first loss of the year to number 8 Dyke New Hartford. Quote, every year we talk about next man up and beating a total team, Kyle said. Sometimes during the year, it's hard to believe that. We have had injuries. We have had a lot of new guys step into big roles. Just really a good belief in our team, and, lucky for us, we have done well, unquote. Sumner Fredericksburg struck first on Friday night, capitalizing on a momentum-shifting goal line stand to drive 94 yards for the opening touchdown of the game. Quarterback Davis Van Sickle lofted a pass to Ty Van Engelberg on fourth and long to take a 7-0 lead in the final minute of the first quarter. Van Engelberg wrestled off solid coverage from Denver to come down with a 17-yard touchdown pass in the back of the end zone. Cougar Jr. Noah Henderson intercepted a pass on the ensuing Cyclones drive to give Sumner Fredericksburg possession in Denver territory. The Cougars capitalized as Van Sickle hit running back Jackson Williams on a 19-yard touchdown pitch and catch to push the lead to 13-0. Denver added a touchdown on a 1-yard run from quarterback Jackson Sanderson with 30 seconds remaining in the half to trim the lead to one score. After trading three and outs to start the second half, Denver drove down to the Sumner Fredericksburg 5-yard line thanks to a 67-yard run from running back Micah Grier. The Cougars' defense held tough, however, forcing a turnover on downs inside its own 10 for the second time. Sumner Fredericksburg added an insurance touchdown with 5 minutes 53 seconds remaining in the fourth quarter on a 19-yard Williams touchdown run to steal the upset victory. Now, here are 5 things fans are buzzing about after the Cougars win Dream Crushers. Last week, it was number 2 NFL Marmack. This week, it was the 4th-ranked Cyclones. Either way, Sumner Fredericksburg has made a habit of knocking off top 10 opponents since the start of district play. According to Van Sickle, the Cougars brought the same energy in both upsets. Quote, "We carried that energy last week," Van Sickle said. Quote, "We just had that feeling that we were come in there and be dream crushers like we were all season. This week was no different. We came in with that mentality, and we were going to win." Quote, "We knew we had a tough schedule coming in, and everybody has those big dreams to make it to the Unidome. We were going to be the ones to stop those dreams from those big teams," unquote. Van Sickle strikes twice. Van Sickle threw a pair of touchdown passes in the first quarter to lift the Cougars to the win. He finished the night with 210.5 quarterback rating, completing 6 of 7 passing attempts for 104 yards with 2 touchdowns. He added 30 yards on the ground on 5 attempts. According to the senior gunslinger, his strong night under center is a credit to the men in the trenches. Quote, "Our line did a phenomenal job," Van Sickle said. "I had all day to throw. That is huge piece. If I do not have to run around, that is awesome. They did a phenomenal job. I had all day," unquote. Cougars' defense stands tall. The Cougars' defense made a very explosive Cyclone offense look quiet and plodding on Friday night, limiting Denver to just 215 yards on the ground, nearly 100 less than its season average. Sumner Fredericksburg also limited the Cyclones to one score, coming up with 3 goal line stands and 2 interceptions in the win. Coyle said the Cougars were ready for the challenge of going up against the strong ground attack of Denver. Quote, "We just put our heads down," Coyle said. "Defensively, we are usually always really good, and we shut down a big offense attack from MFL last week. That was 3 guys carrying the ball. Here, we were able to shut that down and make them throw a little bit more than they are used to." Quote, "We joke as coaches all the time that our defense is really good in short yardage, and our offense seems to be really good in 4th and long. That played again tonight, Big tests to our guys to dig deep, stay buckled down, and outwork the other team. Williams makes statement in Battle of Starbacks. Coming into the top 10 matchup, all eyes were on Denver's Micah Grier. The senior running back racked up 1,027 yards and 14 touchdowns through the first five games. Grier showed out again on Friday with 123 yards on 17 attempts, but Sumner Fredericksburg's Williams stole the show late. With a slim 13-7 lead and the ball on its own side of the field, Williams told Coyle to put the ball in his hands to seal the win. Quote, I went up to Coyle and I was like, I am here if you need me. Just give me the ball and I will pound it, Williams said. Coyle turned Williams' way, and the senior delivered twice on what proved to be the game-winning drive. Williams first picked up the Cougars' first down of the drive with a 15-yard rush to midfield. A few plays later, Williams broke free and the left side of the defense and put the game away with a 19-yard touchdown run. Quote, after that touchdown, I think we were all kind of felt like it was right there, Williams said. Denver looks to rebound. Following their first loss of the season, Denver head coach Rhett Barrett said Sumner Fredericksburg just outplayed Denver. Quote, we did not execute very well, Barrett said. We were in the red zone two times and we did not score. That's on me. I have to do a better job of making sure we have the plays to put us in the end zone and making sure they execute. We have some things to work on this week to get better for MFL. Quote, they beat us. They were better than we tonight. We just did not execute very well at all on offense and defense. We're just very flat, but good teams do that to you. So we have to regroup and come back. The Cyclones face number 10 NFL Marmac on Friday at 7 p.m. Iowa Oktoberfest taking place this weekend in downtown Waterloo. The annual Iowa Oktoberfest will be held on Friday and Saturday in downtown Waterloo at Anton's Beer Garden. The two-day event will be filled with traditional German culture, music, games, and German food. Festivities kick off with a keg tapping ceremony at 5:30 p.m. on Friday. The Marv Nissen Band, a polka variety family band from Minnesota, will perform from 5:30 to 8 o'clock p.m. Following that act, Waterloo's Donnie Heffernan will take the stage. Games will include cornhole, hammer and nails, and a stein hoist. On Saturday, the day begins at 11 a.m. with the Barktoberfest parade, where registered pets can parade down the street in costumes to win prizes. Participants can test their axe-throwing skills, watch the Iowa Hawkeyes game, and indulge in German-inspired cuisine and beers. A harvest sale from noon to 4 p.m. will offer discounted mums for $15, pumpkins for $8, and straw bales for $10. The night ends with Crazy Delicious performing at 8 p.m. The band is known for music spanning various genres and decades. For more information, go online to iowaoktoberfest.com. And now, listeners, it's time to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 4th on IRIS. IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
Kate fell in love with her husband after one date, and with her son after one look, and she risked it all by trying meth just one time. Meth never, ever. Visit yourlifeiowa.org, brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today comes from Margaret Renkel of the New York Times, titled, great books will always be their own best defense. During my grade school years in the early 1970s, I read everything. Books, of course. Books about dogs and teen detectives and gruesomely martyred saints. But also the morning newspaper and the evening newspaper, a long-dead relative's ancient encyclopedias, my father's Reader's Digest, my mother's Southern Living. In the time-honored tradition of nerds everywhere, I read the backs of cereal boxes with the same rapt attention that I devoted to Old Yeller and Nancy Drew. If there were words before me, I read them. By sixth grade, I had exhausted the school's library appealing options and moved on to the county bookmobile. When children's books proved too short to hold me through the long, unoccupied days of summer, I started choosing books from the adult sections too, just to have enough to read until the bookmobile came back. The driver, unsure how to manage this wondrously ecumenical but often wildly inappropriate range of titles, asked my mother to sign a form that gave me permission to check out anything I cared to read. My mother didn't hesitate to sign it, and then paid no attention to the books I chose. If she had, she would have discovered that, tucked among the books like Dracula and All Creatures Great and Small, and The Complete Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, were titles like The Stepford Wives and Valley of the Dolls and Jaws. I doubt Mom would have been thrilled to discover that in learning about the great white sharks, I was also picking up some unexpected information about what adults in the midst of an extramarital affair could do with their hands in the front seat of a moving car. But the subject never came up. As Banned Books Week gets underway, I've been thinking again about the bookmobile. My parents were Goldwater Republicans who sent their children to Catholic school. And yet for them, the very idea of policing my reading was laughable. What parent, left or right, doesn't want to raise a reader? My parents trusted that I understood the difference between fiction and my own life, and I did. Among today's conservatives, this attitude is almost impossible to imagine. During the 2022-2023 school year, PEN America, P-E-N, America, an advocacy organization that defends free expression, recorded 3,362 instances of book banning, an increase of 33% in just 1 year. Quote, overwhelmingly, book bans target books on race or racism or featuring characters of color, as well as books with LGBTQ+ characters, notes the organization's report. Although some liberals want books banned too, for them, it's often classic titles like The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and To Kill a Mockingbird, which treat race in a way that is problematic. Most bans are instigated by conservatives, who increasingly target not just school libraries, but classroom book collections and public libraries as well. These efforts are taking place within the context of a much larger Republican tyranny of the minority. Book bans belong to the same categorical crime against democracy, as denying red state citizens the full range of medical care available to the citizens of blue states, the same crime against democracy as denying LGBTQ people their full civil rights, and the same crime as rewriting textbooks to avoid the reality of white violence against black people. Republicans are doing everything possible to prevent an entire culture from moving toward inclusiveness, diversity, and freedom. And their terror campaigns can be very effective. Libraries have always been welcoming places for Americans, particularly American children. A library is a safe place for exploring the full range of human experience and human thought, all under the supervision of knowledgeable and loving adults. Librarians are the heroes who love books and the human beings who read them, and who know how to help the readers find the books they need. You wouldn't know any of that from the culture wars. Without defining what is meant by these terms, laws have been enacted in red states that would send librarians to prison for, quote, providing sexually explicit, obscene, or harmful books to children, unquote, notes an analysis by the Washington Post. Quote, I've been called a pedophile. I've been called a groomer. I've been called a communist pornographer, one librarian told Xatel Gonzalez of The Atlantic. The attacks have been so relentless and so demoralizing that some 300,000 teachers and librarians have left the profession. It's important to note that most Americans, including a majority of Republicans, support teachers and librarians and oppose book bans. The attacks are the work of a minuscule minority of conservatives. When the Washington Post analyzed 986 complaints against specific books filed during the 2021-22 school year, it found that a majority were issued by the same 11 people. You read that right? 11. Across the red states, hundreds of popular titles have been removed from public school and community libraries, in many cases on the basis of a single complaint. Americans are finally beginning to fight back, and the pushback isn't coming only from advocacy organizations like the American Library Association and PEN America. Authors and artists are fighting back. Students are fighting back. Parents are fighting back. If everyone who opposes book bans got involved, the whole effort would die overnight. Book banners do not have numbers on their side. They don't have reality on their side either. These days, books exist in the forms that cannot be reduced to ashes. If your library is no longer allowed to offer a particular title, there's a good chance you can get it online from the Digital Public Library of America, which just began an initiative called the Banned Book Club. Banned titles are available through a free e-reader app. The relationship between writer and reader is a unique form of intimacy. Every reader brings to the reading a self that is marked by time and place, a self that can never be replicated, not even on a second reading. Conservatives who presume to understand how a particular book will affect a particular child profoundly misunderstand how children actually read, how anyone reads. In the end, great books will always be their own best defense. Imaginative literature survives not by merely communicating information, and even less by attempting to inculcate a worldview. A truly great book tells a story that allows readers to place themselves safely in the larger world. Human beings are storytelling creatures, and reading books is one way we come to understand our part in the entire, expansive, miraculous human story. A book reminds us that we are not alone, that our own lives, which too often feel small and insignificant, are part of a story that can be terrible and full of pain, but also astonishing and often magnificent. Children instinctively understand that truth about the books they read, whether their parents want them to or not. And a note to the listener here, Margaret Renkel is a contributing opinion writer and is the author of the books Graceland at Last and Late Migrations. Her next book, The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year, will be published this month. And also, listeners, you may want to check with your local library to see what they have for sources for audiobooks. Many of them do have a free source for audiobooks. One of them many include is called Overdrive. We turn now to the Storm Lake Times pilot, author Amber Mohammed, for an opinion piece titled Poverty Just Jumped, and it was no accident. After hitting a record low of 7.8% in 2021, new data show the government's supplemental poverty measure jumped to 12.4% last year. That's a nearly 60% increase, and it's all because politicians allowed proven income support programs to expire. I'm an expert on poverty. I lived it most of my life in Iowa. I studied it as a Bill Emerson National Hunger Fellow in rural West Virginia and in Washington, D.C., and now I help people experiencing poverty across the country tell their own stories to change policy. People can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, get an education, and work multiple jobs. But the face of rising prices, low wages, high rents, and a broken healthcare system, it's often not enough. Without a safety net and a level playing field for families, financial security is often out of reach. When I was growing up in Des Moines, my mom had a stable job with the state, but her pay wasn't enough for a real home for my two siblings and me. Iowa, like every state, has a low-income housing crisis. And families of color like mine experience greater challenges obtaining affordable housing. We bounced around shelters, churches, and motel rooms. Despite a stigma about accepting public assistance, we benefited from SNAP, also known as food stamps, and the Women, Infants, and Children, the WIC program. Like many other low-income families, we had to navigate the benefits cliff. When my mother made just $10 more, we'd lose the benefits we needed for sufficient regular meals. My father suffered from opioid addiction. When he was eventually able to get stable employment and rejoin our family, we finally got an apartment where the schools were decent, but a brain aneurysm suddenly took his life, and we ended up back on the opposite side of the city, where the underfunded schools offered less opportunity. I wanted to stay in my school, so I spent 4 hours a day commuting on public buses and on foot. I knew I needed to get into college to be able to help my family financially. Now I have a steady job, and so does my husband. But everyday struggles don't end. The brokenness of our healthcare system burst into my life again when our baby was born with a fatal condition. The medical costs ran nearly $1 million in just the first few months of his tragically short life. What could prepare someone for that? Thankfully, my employer pays 100% of my health insurance. That's a rarity. If I'd been out of work or worked elsewhere, we would have gone bankrupt as we suffered the most tragic thing that could ever happen to us as parents. These are just a few of the structural obstacles low-income people face every day. But there are solutions. The advocates I work with reported enormous relief after politicians finally agreed to invest in helping children and families during the COVID-19 crisis. The expanded child tax credit cut child poverty nearly in half. Expanded food programs through SNAP lifted more than 3 million people out of poverty and staved off an expected spike in hunger. Housing subsidies kept nearly 2.5 million people out of poverty and in their homes, and Medicaid enrollment protections reduced the number of uninsured people by 1.5 million. The year those programs were implemented, the supplemental poverty measure fell to 7.8%, its lowest ever level. But when politicians rejected continuing this vital help for families, it increased by a record amount. This is a failure for families across the country. We need to renew and expand these programs as soon as possible. Poverty is solvable. We know it works. Why don't we do it? The author of this editorial is Lakeisha McVeigh, and she is a bereaved mother, social justice advocate, and leader of the Experts on Poverty program at Results. This op-ed was distributed by otherwords.org. Next, we have a piece by the editorial board of the New York Times. Americans deserve better from the House of Representatives. The U.S. Capitol may be perched on a hill, but it is understandable why so many Americans look down on it. One of the main reasons is that their Congress, which ought to be a global beacon of liberal values, continues to succumb to self-inflicted paralysis. How else can it be that fewer than a dozen lawmakers from the outer fringes of the Republican Party are holding one of the world's oldest democracies hostage to their wildest whims. On Tuesday, a small group of Republicans effectively shut down all business in the House when they voted to oust Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. Though 210 of 218 House Republicans supported him, he lost his job when just 8 members of the caucus voted against him, joining all Democrats who voted. Without a Speaker, the House can get nothing done. There will be no votes or even debate about paying for the government's operations, though the money runs out in 6 weeks. There will be no discussion of how to help Ukraine, or how to deal with the nation's immigration crisis, or any of the other crises facing Washington. Even before he lost his job, Mr. McCarthy and his caucus lurched the nation from debt limit crises to shutdown crisis to win debating points that might help them in the next elections, rather than pass meaningful legislation that addresses the nation's challenges. We're now in the middle of yet another pointless fight, this time over the funding of the federal government and the leadership of the House. Republicans in the House showed briefly on Saturday that they were willing to do the right thing and compromise to avoid a shutdown. In the upcoming votes to choose a new speaker, they can and should do that again by showing their commitment to responsible governance. If Democrats can help achieve that, they should. The next candidates for speaker could win Democratic votes by promising a different course, one that brings both parties together for the common good. Any other candidate for the job will also face the same choice. Voters have given Republicans a majority of the seats in the House and thus control over selecting the Speaker, who sets the agenda in the House. Those voters, in turn, should expect the body to serve the people who elected them. It's possible that the Republican Party is already ready to again choose pragmatism over partisanship. Last weekend, Mr. McCarthy sought and received the support of hundreds of Democrats to pass a continuing resolution to fund the federal government, a measure that pushed a potential government shutdown 45 days down the road. It's hard to get excited about a victory in a fight that never needed to happen, especially at the last possible moment. But the saga reflects the reality of D.C. today. Bipartisan compromise has become the sole path to governing in the United States in 2023. Democrats have the White House and a one-seat majority in the Senate, while Republicans control the House of Representatives and appointed a supermajority of conservatives on the Supreme Court. President Biden's executive authority extends only as far as the courts have allowed, while the only path through the Senate is with enough bipartisan support to skirt the shoals of a filibuster. The government, like the nation, is divided. But political polarization is not the excuse for inaction that so many grandstanding politicos too often take it to be. With a divided Congress, the only way to get any legislation passed is with some support from the center of both parties. A Congress that operated in a more bipartisan manner could move the country beyond its impasses over issues like immigration or the sustainability of the social safety net. A more confident center-right party that doesn't genuflect to Donald Trump would have an easier time achieving those ambitious acts of self-governance. While that's a tall order, it's not impossible. Just look at the past few days. Mr. McCarthy did the right thing on Saturday, outmaneuvering the radicals in his own party, led by Representative Matt Gaetz, to keep the federal government open. The next speaker needs to deprive Mr. Gaetz and his ilk of the weapon they've been using to force the House leadership into compliance with their demands. Congress represents more than 330 million Americans. Mr. Gaetz and his allies should not be given a heckler's veto over the business of government. It was a conscious choice by the ousted Speaker of the House to give them one. In the face of intransigence from his right flank, the next leader should drop the anachronistic practice that demands Republicans bring up only legislation backed by a majority of their members, the so-called Hastert Rule, named for Dennis Hastert, the disgraced former speaker, appears nowhere in the Constitution and can be used to prevent the House from moving forward with bipartisan legislation. A new speaker should also commit to plain dealing with the Democratic colleagues and may need them to prevent another putsch. Mr. McCarthy lost faith among Democrats by failing to keep his word and honor a deal over spending caps that he negotiated with the White House in May. The next speaker might consider that a good starting point for negotiations. Once a new speaker is chosen, the House will have less than 45 days to avert another standoff over the shutdown, and members of goodwill in both parties will again need to show that they are willing and able to compromise. The Democrats could permit more spending on border security, and Republicans could continue the vital flow of aid to Ukraine, among other issues. The House Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, said Tuesday that his caucus would remain willing to find common ground on an enlightened path forward, one that did not leave the public's business at the mercy of a few extremists. Whichever leader Republicans now choose should agree to a similar path. Now a new diner is coming to Cedar Falls Main Street, Dateline Cedar Falls. Work has begun to bring a new breakfast spot to Main Street. The planned business has ties to a downtown staple and is being named in honor of the area's locomotive history. Patton Bar and Diner is expected to open next spring at 317 Main Street, the former Lotus Plus Lou storefront. The venture, taken on by Corey Kent and partners Brent Kai, Coyle Kent, and Jack Ogden, and Brian Wingert, is driven by a feeling there are too few options to grab an early morning meal along the city's main drag. Quote, "We hope to go back to that time of the classic diner," said Kent. "Especially being from Iowa, with all the small communities, the diner's been that place you can go and always count on, and will be there 30, 40, 50 years. We want it to be that place where you can comfortably and casually go to grab breakfast, but also serve a quick lunch and great dinner with cool main entrees," unquote. Kent discussed his plans with a courier alongside Sam Koch, who wears multiple hats and handles business operations at the partner's other Cedar Falls venture, George's Local. That restaurant is located in what had once been an auto service station at the corner of Main and East 4th Streets. Patton is a reference to the streetcars that first appeared in Cedar Falls in 1897. Gasoline and later electric-powered motor cars made trips between the Iowa State Normal School, now the University of Northern Iowa, and the corner of 1st and Main Street. They went on to operate between Cedar Falls and Waterloo, according to CedarNet, an electronic historical archive. Kent used a similar tribute to one of his other restaurants, the Pullman Bar and Diner, in Iowa City. The Pullman Company manufactured railroad cars, including dining cars. The partners, operating as Synergy Investments, also purchased the neighboring storefront at 315 Main Street, formerly home to Scratch Cupcakery. Kent said they're considering another food and drink establishment, but nothing is finalized. The 2,000 square foot space for the diner is being gutted and is in the bare bones stage of construction. Once finished, Kent expects it to seat 60 to 70 people who can walk in without reservations and be served by the eatery, employing about 40 people. Customers will find a shotgun-style layout, a long, skinny rectangular frame with a counter, bar, booth seating, an open kitchen, nice facade, and big front window. The diner will be open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Quote, "It will be an old-school classic diner from the 60s or 70s, but we'll throw in some unexpected fresh twists and a modern elevated menu, Kent said. Maybe some biscuits and gravy with chorizo, fresh cut scallions, or sunny side up eggs, unquote. Fried chicken and a classic smash burger are also on his mind, along with coffee and freshly squeezed orange juice. There also will be alcoholic drinks like mimosas and Bloody Marys, along with other cocktails, beers, and wines. The menu is still a work in progress, but almost everything will be made from scratch. Executive chef Jorge Santiago, who leads the kitchen at George's Local, will also head Patton Bar and Diner. Kent said while they may have small similarities, they'll have their own identities. Quote, we're trying to leave them separate, he said. They'll feel different, and we want them to remain true to themselves, unquote. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 4th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state of Iowa that we record. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.